The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
You guys are amazing. I mean, you really, really have incredible talent. And when we heard the story about all the connections and all the family and stuff, that makes it even more special. So I just want to say thank you guys very much for all that you're doing. Because you're actually out there, you're inspiring this nation. When you go, when you went around New England and up and down the seaboard, wherever else you go, you are inspiring this nation. And that's something that we need right now. So thanks for doing that, okay? All of you, every single one of you, every single one of you has amazing talent. So thank you very much, and thank you for your smile.
There you have it, General Michael Flynn in town in Edmond, Oklahoma, visiting Armstrong Auditorium yesterday afternoon as he was one of the audience members to view the encore performance of Celtic Throne. We have him in town for tonight's engagement in the same venue. And of course, as I told you last week, he's also right here in the studio with us. So we'll get to our interview with General Flynn in just a moment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. You can get to the live video stream of this show at trumpetdaily.com. And of course, don't forget about our Rumble channel. We're going to be off the charts today as Rumble's giving us some extra promotional efforts to broadcast this show or to promote this show. And General Flynn has as well. We appreciate you sending out the tweet about the show to your followers.
It's wonderful. It's a great experience for me. Being here and back in Oklahoma and being in Edmond and being on the Armstrong College campus. What a beautiful, beautiful location. And, you know, even though we're going through a heat wave, I'm coming up from Florida, so it's not that bad. I actually enjoy it. And I'm glad that I'm glad to be here with the audience today. And I really, really look forward to a couple of hours of a great discussion.
Great. I can't, just to go back to Celtic Throne, I can't tell you how excited the performers were. A lot of them are, you know, 10, 12 years of age, in their teens, early 20s. And when they heard that you were coming and that you would most likely be in attendance, they really were excited to rev up the show again.
Well, I mean, for me, and you saw a little piece there, but I just went through the, they have an elementary school here on the installation on the campus. And I met with kindergartners, first graders, second graders, third graders, and I sat down with the fifth grade a group of kids. We took some photos and stuff, but we talked about, you know, the kinds of things that are going on in their lives, and you see these like faces, and it just makes you. And I, you know, one of the young girls that I met in the fifth grader, she has the same name as my granddaughter, so it's very personal for me. And you know, she's 11 years old, and when I look at the faces of these children, that's why I do what I do. And I always tell people I have four grandchildren, so I have four reasons to fight for our country the way that I fight for our country as I go around across the country to raise our voices and make sure people understand what it is that we're up against and what we're and how as American citizens how we can step up and stand up and speak up and get out of this sort of America in crisis, right? I mean, that's sort of where we're at today. So it's just a real honor for me to be here. Seeing those children last night, seeing those, which is one big family, this Celtic Throne, I mean, just amazing. And then seeing the children this morning, many of whom participated in that, in last night's just beautiful piece of artwork, really, when you think about it, these people, these young kids floating across the stage.
Right.
Just wonderful, wonderful experience for me.
And you got to enjoy our swimming pool today as well.
Swimming.
How was that?
Swimming. I swim. So I, you know, because of my bones and my body has taken a beating of jumping out of airplanes for so many years of my life, my military career and running and push-ups and all that kind of stuff. So I enjoy swimming. I've always enjoyed swimming from the time I was a kid. I surf. I've been surfing, wave surfing for over 50 years of my life. I still own, I think, 8 or 9 surfboards.
Water polo.
I played water polo in college. These guys, when Steve was tooling me around the campus yesterday. It was great. And one of the things, when we went up and we saw the athletic facilities, beautiful athletic facilities, I saw a pool and I go, oh, is that, you know, can anybody swim in that pool? He goes, sure. And I said, boy, I'd love to go for a swim in the morning. So I was able to get in that pool about 7:30. I actually did an interview with the local radio station from the pool, and then went and swam a bunch of laps. And it's refreshing, and it's sort of my safe space when I go into the water. And water is a great metaphor for, I think, a lot of the things that we're facing in this country today, because water can be turbulent, tides, you know, ebb and flow. There's tidal waves, there's big waves. The ocean can be very powerful, but we also have to, and it can cause us to, I've been crushed by big waves, driven underneath, and had to stay underneath for long periods of time. And you can get a sense of fear. And what you learn, particularly in the lifetime of surfing that I've done, you learn to not, you don't lose fear, but you overcome it, and you're able to control it, and you're able to rise back above. And that's kind of where America's at. And I think America right now is in that ebb and flow of the big tides and this big ocean that is our beautiful country. And I think a lot of people are fearful to a degree. I really do believe that. And so what I want to try to do is get people to understand how to control their fear and control that emotion. You don't lose it, but you can control it. And once you've controlled it, then you are in total control of your life. And that's how you can move forward. And that's how we will move forward as a nation. And we're going to do it. We're going to move forward as a nation because we're going to be able to control that element of fear. And that's where hope comes in. That's where inspiration comes in. And that's where each of us in our own communities, particularly this beautiful community that you guys have created here, it just proves to me once again how we can take control of our lives here in America and move this country forward the way that we know it must be driven. And so that's kind of me. That's it's one of the things that I really like to, I talk about that, and that's a little bit about me. So I appreciate you asking me about swimming. I appreciate you opening up that pool, outdoor pool. Oklahoma, you know, has had a heat wave, so the temperature was about right, and it was wonderful to be able to do that.
Just one more point on living a life that's active or mm-hmm. getting involved in sports. You, on the trip out here, you had mentioned about President Trump and how that when he's obviously in his late 70s now, he's still very energetic and vibrant. And you talked about how that when early in his life, he was an avid baseball player and very active and into sports. How do you feel like, you know, you saw these kids perform yesterday? How important is it for young people to have activities and sports and competitive type things that goes toward, you know, developing their character?
Yeah, I think that it's hugely important. And what I was talking about with Steve on our trip up was really about, you know, people look at a guy like Donald Trump and, you know, there's so many things that are just falsehoods as to way the media presents about him. They're just absolutely horrific in many cases. But, you know, and just to touch on him before the main point, you know, Trump is a man who's never smoked, never drank. His parents lived till they were in their 90s. He's a very, very healthy guy. I mean, when I was running around them, and you see him at these big, still these big rallies, when he was in high school, and when he was in his younger days, he was really, particularly in baseball, he was sort of at the professional level. I mean, he was a great athlete. And all you got to do is go back and look at his young life. So athletics is something that I think for me, because I was always athletically inclined, and I, you know, was in sports. I was on championship teams. I did a variety of things, not just surfing and swimming. I played, you know, basketball, baseball, football in high school. I got back into swimming in college and started playing water polo. And I think that our character can be strengthened by the teamwork that we get involved in. And I think that's really what it's about, because it's not just about the, you know, those that are really the top athletes in a particular sport. It's about joining, you know, and participating in some type of sporting competitions or sporting events, partly because it's good for your health, if nothing else. It causes you to have to focus on being part of a team and working as a team. And I can tell you, as a kid, way back, you know, playing in all the different sports and being part of boys clubs, as an example, I swam at boys clubs. I learned how to box at boys clubs. That developed me as I got into the military and I got into the Army. When you're really now, you're going to have to really work as a closer member of a team. And I think that the teamwork, the character development, the leader development, the idea about maintaining a healthy lifestyle, because as you get older, you know, your life, you know, as anybody that's watching this that's older, I'm 64 years old today, now my birthday is in another couple of months, I'll turn 65. I mean, I want to live a long, healthy life, and I want to do that because, you know, I think that this moment of history needs a lot of different people, and I feel blessed to be alive right now. And so this idea of being involved in sports, being involved in any sort of competition, watching those young people last night, I mean, the strength, the ability, their sort of artistic performance, the way that they were synchronized on that stage. And, you know, it's like I will say it as sort of Irish step dancing, right? There was a lot of Irish step dancing, just beautiful. And for anybody that hasn't seen it, you're watching these amazing, amazing, talented young people. They're like floating across the stage. I mean, they just float across the stage. And yet they're moving their feet at a rate that I can't even imagine. But the Celtic Throne was a beautiful performance of not only our culture and the culture of the world. And as they brought the story through the whole couple of acts that they performed last night, all the way through to how those strong cultures of the Irish, the Scottish, the British came into our country, it was beautiful. And I think that's a big part of what we need to always remember, is the strength and strength comes from this competitive spirit of America. But it's not only the strength of being an athlete, it's the strength of being one of good character. And that drives all the way into the diversity of this beautiful country of ours.
You were saying, just following on that, you were saying last night, because of where you are in your life, as you say, you're in your 60s, and then you see young people. Some of us were asking you, what is it that really drives you and motivates you? I mean, aside from Donald Trump, you're maybe one of the most persecuted Americans in the nation. So what is it that keeps you going and keeps you positive and keeps you personally hopeful?
Yeah, I can't, people send me these quotes from the Bible all the time about, those that have been persecuted in the Bible. And, and I won't try to quote that because I'm not an expert on that. I feel it, though. When you talk about why do I get persecuted the way that I get persecuted, and you go back and you look at Trump, I jokingly say, if he's getting a subpoena or something, I'm probably getting one. I mean, I just was on the phone this morning on all this stuff. I mean, one of the things that exists in life is, and I say this, and I said this we were talking earlier about the 2016 convention, where I spoke at the 2016 convention, and during that speech, I made the statement that the sobering reality is that evil exists. And I want people to understand that. The sobering reality is that evil exists. And evil exists in mankind. It exists in humanity. It exists on earth. And so we have to understand that there are components of that that are, they're going to constantly attack sort of the opposite of that. They're going to attack the good. They're going to attack the light. They're going to attack the truth. They're going to attack what's good in our lives, right? And what's good in our lives, what we're trying to do is we're trying to keep our country on this even keel. We're a democracy, but we're actually a constitutional republic. And we have this beautiful document that is our Constitution. I always carry our Constitution with us. And, you know, beautiful, a great picture of George Washington on the front, the Constitution of the United States. It's only keepers, the people, right? It's only keepers, the people. And so for us to maintain this little, barely, you can barely see it there, audience, this little thing, got the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence in it. For us to be able to maintain this thing, we have to keep ourselves on this sort of authentic and honest path, right? And it doesn't mean that we're perfect. I'll be I'm the most imperfect guy, and I've made lots of mistakes. But when we talk about the direction that we're going as a country, there are few Americans today that are adults, at least, paying attention, that have to maybe go to a job, raise a family, you know, pay for mortgage or rent in a place, go buy a loaf of bread, go spend your money on a gallon of gas these days. You know, it's $4 a gallon. I mean, this is insane. So we all know that there's something not right about our country. And what people are having a hard time figuring out is this a Democrat versus Republican, right? We have long in the tooth politicians that talk about our country like, well, you know, this is still my ideas about big government, your ideas about little government, my ideas about less taxes, your ideas about more taxes. We're past that. We are so past that. This 40, 50 years, and I can go back and, you know, we can have a class on U.S. history over the last 75 years since the end of World War II, if you'd like, but maybe we'll touch a little bit on that. But I go back to this idea that evil exists. The competition that right now that we are facing is what I would call Americanism versus globalism. Okay? And there is a globalist elite that, and when I say globalist, they're not all sitting in Washington, D.C. There's a globalist elite that actually looks at the world and says, we know what's better for humanity. We know what's better for the global population. We know what's better for for the world. And versus this idea about national sovereignty, right? And I've been called every name in the book. You know, I'm not, I know what nationalism is. And I'm not talking about nationalism. I'm talking about taking care of our home first. And so it's like in life, right? If your house is on, if your stove has a stove fire because you know, it's a grease fire, what do? Do you walk outside and go, you know, park the car in the garage? No, you put the stove fire out. You put the fire out. You manage that fire. You get it to where you can control it. And maybe you grab the pan that it was started in, and you take it out the back door and you throw it in the grass, right? I mean, I've seen that. My mother did that one time, and I watched that. And I'm like, you know, because she knew what to do. And so it's that simple of an example of an analogy that is happening to our country. We have fires going on in our country, and yet we're spending billions and billions and billions of dollars over in places like Eastern Europe. We're allowing millions of people to invade our country, all right? Not just tens of millions, now it's hundreds of millions. I mean, we're in a place now where when we start to think about our country, you know, we don't really know. We had our census, and our census says, you know, let's just say, I think it was 320 million people in this country. We really don't know what the other number is. I mean, in the last couple of years, we've seen, I think, 5 or 6 million people that we know of. So certainly tens of millions of people that are coming into our country illegally. And it's not just, you know, woe is these people and where they're coming from. Their lot in life is terrible. I understand all that, and I have immense sadness for them. But what it causes inside of our country, it's like that stove fire that I just talked about. It could burn the kitchen. It could burn the dining room. It could burn the living room. It could burn the house down if we don't get it under control. And so when you start to think about, and I call it killed in action, because this is like an American battlefield when we're talking about these drug cartels. So killed in action on the streets of America by fentanyl, by Chinese produced and made and routed through the Mexican border, the southern border, you know, killed in action in this country is over 100,000 people, right? 100,000 Americans killed in action by Chinese produced fentanyl. And then the cost of our on our healthcare system, the cost on our education system, the rising rates of crime, yet we have the globalist, right, the globalist element, which you know, we can get into more defined as to who they are and particular ideologies, but that globalist element will tell you in everything that I just described, particularly the rising rates of crime, they'll say, well, we want to defund the police. And what people don't realize is defunding the police, eliminating local policing is something that one of the things that the Bolshevik Revolution did way back in the 100 years ago, right? So defunding the police means we want to eliminate local policing. But what is it that our government is doing? So they want to eliminate your ability to be able to have local police take care of your local neighborhoods and your cities, your parishes, your towns, and your counties. They really do. And they want to grow federal level police, you know, vis-a-vis 87,000 IRS agents. These are not accountants that they're hiring. And they're, you know, and we've, you know, you don't even hear about it anymore, but this is 87,000 people, most of whom are going to be agents at the federal level to be law enforcement protectors of the IRS, of the Internal Revenue Service. So there's a lot that I just said there, but it all comes back to, you know, we must take care of our own homes first. And then once we've done that, then we can, you know, still be this shining city on a hill, this, you know, this true north beacon for the rest of the world. And you know what, America? We can juggle a couple of things at the same time. We can juggle the requirements for our country that must be adhered to and must be, you know, fixed and corrected, particularly the rule of law. We can do that. And at the same time, we can also be benevolent to other parts of the world, other partnerships, alliances that we have to be able to help, you know, where there's tragedy, to be able to help where there's tyranny. We can do that. We can do that. We are so capable of doing that. But before we start thinking about those things that we're doing overseas, which is a lot of what this, when I look at the foreign policy of this current administration, I'm like saying, we have massive, we have stove fires, you know, our kitchen's on fire, our living room is on fire, the upstairs bedrooms are on fire, the bathroom's on fire, the garage is burning and our cars are already burned, you know, and yet we're worrying about these other things before we fix our own home. And so, you know, that's my soapbox. Anyway,
you were saying last night that America First did not originate with Donald Trump.
No,
I mean, that's,
nope.
That's something that's been around for quite some time. But the ones that are attacking that, yeah, that America First movement, really do hate the country.
Oh, they hate the country. They hate that phrase. America First has been around many, many years, at least 50, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even more. You know, Donald Trump is, his bumper sticker is Make America Great Again, right? Make America Great Again. And people will go, well, America's great. Well, America has some warts, right? We have some warts. I just highlighted a whole bunch of them. And many of those have been in existence for 50 years. I mean, look at our education system, you know, look at our education system alone. We're spending more money in this country on education than like the next 10 countries combined. And yet I think we're rated at like 30 in what I would call legitimately defined nation states. We're like at the, you know, we're at the bottom, really, when it comes to that. And we're spending more money combined. So why? You know, you have to ask why. And you have to say to yourself, when you look at the Department of Education at the federal level, number one, it hasn't been around that long, but for the time that it's been around, we have seen an education system, particularly public school education system, in decline. That's why you begin to see over the last couple of years, particularly with COVID, and maybe we touch on COVID what's being portended, you know, into the future here. But when you look at what's happening with many, particularly women, you know, moms around this country, where they're pulling their children out of school, and we see the increase of homeschooling, or, you know, again, for the people that are listening to this show, and I'm, you know, this is my first visit here to this campus, I'm blown away by what these guys do, and who they are, and what they represent, and how they do their educational the educational underpinnings of what they're teaching here. I mean, you know, it's common sense. It's like what I learned. It's what I learned in the school system that I went to, which was, we were talking to first graders and fifth graders this morning about phonics and vowels. They sang this beautiful vowel song, right? About, I mean, it's these basics. They're learning about civics, right, in our country. If, you know, if I was to sit with a and debate somebody on the left, somebody who's a Marxist, and debate them, you know, they would call me a white Christian nationalist and you know, whatever names they want to sling my way, because I want to talk about what's great about America. And that's really, when we talk about America first, it's like your home. And I want to keep this driving this this metaphor or this analogy home. It is about our homes, right? And about your families and about our communities, right? And I always say, you know, some people have misinterpreted it. I always say that most people really only care about what's 50 feet from their door. And it's a metaphor for taking care of our communities. And I use this phrase, local action equals a national impact. And so if you get involved locally, you get involved in your communities locally, and you do the things that you know need to be done, you're going to have a national impact. And I can tell you from this visit, and this is what fires me up. This is where I get my energy, because trust me, folks, this is exhausting. This is exhausting. And I mean it. It's exhausting because, you know, I want more people to rise up. I want more people to stand up. I want more people in their local communities to speak up. And it is happening around the country, you know, more and more. And I hope that it happens even more so. But this visit here is a reminder, and it re-energizes me to have the perspective that I need, that there is a goodness in the fabric of our country, and it's represented by some of these young people that I met last night and some of the kids that I met this morning. And I know, having in the last week and a half, going to Michigan, I went to Iowa, I went to Ohio, I leave here, I go out to California, and then I go into Nevada. I mean, and one of the things that I always look for is not these conversations, and I love this conversation, and I appreciate you giving me this soapbox, you know, with the Trumpet Daily. But I, you know, what I look for is I look for the young people, I look for the youth, particularly children, because I have children and I have grandchildren. So I look to see that, you know, my mom used to call it, and I joked last night with Steve, my mom used to call it forced family fun. My mother would drag us to events, right? And we'd all be kicking and screaming, going, you know, I don't want to go there, Mom. But my mother would take us there, and, you know, you'd learn something, right? You learn something. And it was important, and it's important to look at what our purpose in life is. As I said earlier, what my age is and the generation that I represent, this is the generation, it's my generation, that is going to have to stand up and speak up to save this nation, because those children, my children, your children, those grandchildren, your grandchildren that are out there, they're all going to school. We're trying to raise them right. The children that represent, you know, my generation, they're out there working, in many cases, a couple of jobs. They're trying to raise their families. And I go back to women, because I find more and more women in this country, and we look at the demographics of our country, we look at what women are doing. This is a very important point, because women are raising our families these days, right? We have so many broken families, and it's a tragedy. To me, because I think a strong family unit, you know, is really will make for a more successful nation. And the globalists and the left and the Democrat Party, and I'll use that, that's probably the only time you'll hear me using that word, you know, from the back in the late 60s all the way till now, they, you know, really, you know, it's like they intentionally went after the family unit. And I mean that. I'm saying that word, I'm using that word intentionally, precisely. They went after the family unit to destroy it, to destroy the fabric of the family. And they did it through a whole variety of things. And there's people that actually talked about it that are part of that party. And now we've shifted to a globalism that is really a form of an, it's an ideology that is, I think, personally, as I served in the military and I had to study and understand and be prepared to fight against these ideologies like communism, like fascism, like, you know, imperialism, whatever isms out there, Islamism, right? Radical Islamism, all of these different things. And so I took the time to study those ideologies and to study those cultures and to study the countries and the regions of the world and to try to understand what it was that I potentially had to advise soldiers to go out and potentially sacrifice their lives. And now it's right here. The biggest battle, the greatest battle that I've personally faced, you know, wasn't in on the battlefields of Central America or Southwest Asia or Central Asia or the plains of Europe, which I spent 10 years of my life preparing for that battlefield to fight, to face communism, right? To face the Warsaw Pact. My greatest battle that I have faced personally and now in this position that I find myself in, and I'm blessed to be here, is right here in my own country. And that's it's a scary thing. It's a really scary thing. And I want people to understand that fear is an emotion that we can control. And like I said earlier, we have to gain control of that emotion of fear. And we have to understand, it's like I'll use this, because I surf and I've surfed in big waves and I've been crushed. You know, you wipe out, right? And you wipe out, go Google wiping out on a wave. You know, you get pounded down below the surface of the water and you can spend, you know, I mean, I used to be able to hold my breath for quite a while, you know, not like some of these big, big wave surfers. I could hold my breath for well over a minute because I practiced that. And I've been underneath the water for that amount of time. And when you finally come up and you take that breath of air, right? It's like, that's what America needs right now. We need to go take that big breath of oxygen, and everybody needs to do that. And then you need to say, okay, I am now going to move in the direction, you know, of the shoreline, and that shoreline is the shoreline of freedom. And when we do that, when more and more Americans actually start to head towards that shoreline of freedom, we're going to reach it. We're going to reach it together. And when we do, we're going to raise that flag. We're going to demonstrate that American pride, and we're going to do that all over this country. And that's when I know, and I see this here, I see this in other parts of the country that I go to, because people are overcoming that emotion of fear, and they know that they're going to eventually rise up, and breathe that beautiful, fill their lungs with that beautiful oxygen, that beautiful air, and we're going to reach the shoreline. And that shoreline means to get to that shoreline, it requires sacrifice. You're going to have to swim. Right? You're going to have to swim. You're going to have to kick. You're going to have to crawl. Whatever it is it takes for you to survive to get to that shoreline. And when you do, believe me, you feel empowered. And I feel empowered. I reached that shoreline. I reached that shoreline in this battle with my own country, with elements of my own country, not with my own country, but with elements inside of my own country who I believe are subversive. They're subversive. And I don't mind saying that. That's the truth.
It's quite a perspective. I mean, you've fought. I mean, you've been in wars abroad. And so this is the most serious war that you've experienced. And it's right here at home. Of course, this is kind of the central theme of my father's book, America Under Attack. And you, just so our audience knows, someone had said, sent you a copy of it a while back.
This is a beautiful book. This book written by Gerald Fleury, who's really the big idea behind this beautiful campus that we're on. And I met him last night, and we had dinner together. And somebody in all my trips around the country, they sent me this book, and they said, you got to read it. And you know, in it there's a chapter on Mike Flynn, but you kind of go, okay, what's he got to say? But the title says it all, America Under Attack. And I recommend people, you know, I read it, and I was telling Steve that I've read a few books in the last few years that have they like shocked me to the core, after I've read it. And I read this, and I read it again this weekend as I prepared to come out here. And as I am, I'm the type of person, like, when I read it, I'm like, okay, who wrote this? You know, now I'm looking at, you know, and I am compelled, and I was compelled to reach out to Gerald Flurry. And so they sent me a bunch of them, because I said, send me as many as you can. And I don't know how many you sent me, maybe 20 or so.
I think it was 20. Yeah.
And I handed them out to my family. I handed them out to everybody. And I said, you got to read this, because it's not just what it says in here about, little old General Mike Flynn. It's what it's the theme of it and the idea behind it. And one of the things that I have learned in the last couple of years, and there's a number of pastors that I have gotten to meet, and those pastors and those people that are of great faith, and they're not necessarily all pastors, but those, the ones I'm thinking about now, that are able to connect, the Bible, right? They're able to connect the Bible to the Constitution and then talk about it in a way that as I like to say, what this describes, what America Under Attack describes, is kind of the who, what, when, where, why, and how. It really does. It's about what it is that we are facing. And he brings this sort of biblical direction in it as he leaves, the reader at the end to make sure that we really do return to the strength of our nation, which is really the foundation of our nation, which is based on Judeo-Christian principles and values. And one of the things that I like to say, and this is why I reached out, and there's been a couple of books that have made me feel like that, and I've reached out to other authors to say, your book had such deep meaning, and then I go out and I tell people, to read them. I mean, I tell people, you got to go read these books. You know, if you want to know what's going on, if you want to understand what's happening, go read it. And one of the things that I say, and I think it's maybe it'll resonate with this audience, but I, kind of doesn't matter. I mean, the way I am. But, when we think about, our Bill of Rights, right, our 10 amendments, our first 10 amendments, and certainly the Bill of Rights that we have in our Constitution, and you think about the 10 commandments, right, the founders, all you got to do is read the Federalist Papers, read the Constitution, read the Declaration of Independence. For those that want to have a little bit more, go read some of the diaries, some of the letters written by the founders to their spouses or to their children. Read some of their own historical accounts of what happened in their diaries, so to speak, that they wrote. They're still available. And one of the things that's very clear is that the Bible, the Constitution was derived from the Bible. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you can argue with me. And the globalists will argue, because they're, for most people, and this is a little bit of a sidebar, but the globalists right now are going to try to attempt to use artificial intelligence to rewrite the Bible. Okay, this is ongoing right now, so just be aware of that, because that's coming, folks. But the our Bill of Rights and the Ten Commandments, if you think about it, are the promises that we make to each other, right? So we make promises to each other. Our Bill of Rights are promises that we make to each other as Americans, that we have all of these rights to be able to be free, right? To be Americans. The Ten Commandments, they also are promises that we make to each other as a faith-based society. And look at what they've done to the Ten Commandments. Look at what the left has done to the Ten Commandments. They've thrown it out of every courthouse. They knocked down the statues. It's unbelievable. But those promises are important. And when you go read the Ten Commandments, go read the Bill of Rights today. Go do that. Takes you probably all of about 20 minutes. Then you take the next step and you dig into the Constitution and you dig into the Bible itself. The Constitution and the Bible are the fulfillment of those promises. So in order to understand the deeper meaning of what our rights are and what the commandments say that we, how we should live, it's all common sense. It is all just common sense. In order to understand the deeper meaning of that, you've got to then dive into the Constitution. And I keep raising this up because it's a little thin thing. It takes you about a good reader, about 45 minutes maybe, to read the whole thing. The Bible is obviously going to take you a little bit longer. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I've read every single word, but I've read or been given enough of it to understand that there are components of it, of the Bible, just like there's components of the Constitution, this, again, the fulfillment of the promises that we make to each other, that are in our daily lives today. And our country is living, there's living proof of that, you know, that whatever they, whoever it was that wrote all these great things thousands of years ago in the Bible, and these, those that wrote this beautiful thing almost 250 years ago, I mean, there's the wisdom and the vision and the meaning is so powerful. And so to be alive today, we don't have an excuse. Nobody in this audience, you know, don't come and tell me, don't give me an excuse about anything, but you don't have an excuse to say, that's for those politicians. That's for those pastors. That's for somebody else to do. As soon as you say that, you've quit. And the only thing that I know in life is that you're done when you quit. And for those who have given, as Abraham Lincoln, one of our, you know, to me, he's the greatest president. You know, as Abraham Lincoln described, you know, it's basically giving the last true measure of devotion, you know, in the cause of a nation, right? That's that last true measure of devotion is the soldier on the battlefield that gave their life up. And I always say that it's not because they hate their enemy. It's because they love their country, or they love their family, or they love their community, you know, or they love the loved ones that they left behind. Mostly it's a young wife and in some cases children. And so, you know, when we try to wrap ourselves in our flag and our freedom, we have to do that, you know, keeping this idea of and the sense of humility to those that actually gave the, you know, that gave the last true measure of devotion, gave the greatest sacrifice that one can give, you know, which is their lives, in standing up for a country, in this case, the United States of America, for freedom, right? For our freedom. And we're under attack. All of our freedoms are under assault, and it's on a daily basis. And I know that this audience is probably a national audience, probably an international audience. And that's, you know, for those that are overseas, you all know what I'm talking about. For those that are in this country, particularly first generation Americans, maybe your parents came from another country legally and came into this country. Maybe they came from communist countries over in Eastern Europe. You know, maybe they came from some other part of the world. And so those first generation Americans know exactly what I'm talking about, because their parents left another country. I mean, how about that? I mean, how about just picking up and leaving a country because you're so afraid of the tyranny that you're about to experience, and you're going for a place that where, you know, you're going to that light, right? That beacon of light, that true North Star that America represents. And when you are doing that, you're doing that knowing you're leaving family, you're leaving a life, and you're leaving your entire family, which goes back maybe hundreds of years in some cases, right? The legacy of, you're leaving all of that, and you're going to some place where you know you're going to have to sacrifice, and you're going to have to commit, and you're going to have to raise a family, you're going to have to go get a job, you're going to have to learn a new language in many cases. So those of us that have been here for a long time, right, couple of generations, I'm second generation or third generation now in this country, and, you know, I mean, we've just sort of taken it for granted. And I hate to tell you, folks, but we've been apathetic and lazy in many cases. And I want people to understand that. I want people to understand that we've got to stop being lazy, we've got to stop being apathetic, and we've got to start being Americans, and the sacrifices here at home. That is you know, how I would tell you to repurpose your life and repurpose your lives and rethink about everything that you've done in the past has been relevant and good and right, but maybe it wasn't enough, right? Maybe it wasn't enough. I saw somebody on the social media today on one of the things that people are out there talking about, one of the things trending. And, you know, one person says, enough is enough. Enough is enough. And I agree. Enough is enough. So now what are we going to do about it? You know, are we just going to sit here and get pounded because America's under attack and go, woe is me, and make up all kinds of excuses? Or are we going to go get involved in your communities? You know, go attend a school board, go run for school board, go run for a local office, go get involved in this country, and let's get these long in the tooth political people who have basically been ripping us off, and let's get them out of there. And I'll get off my soapbox in 1 second, because when I say that, people go, well, we have an election system that's not fair. And we have a selection system, not an election system. And I don't disagree. So go fix it in your county. You can fix it in your county. You can fix it in your county by not taking money, right? And saying, in our county, this is where the Constitution comes in. In our county, we're going to have no machines. We're going to have same-day ballots. We're going to have ID cards, you know, with pictures. I mean, we're going to have just common sense thing, and we're going to count our ballots on that day, right? Because you got, you know, in a large county, you might have 100 precincts. Believe me, folks, we can do this. We've done this in the past. So anyway, that's just.
You said the other night that October 2020, this was when, I guess, the DOJ finally dropped the charges, and you said that something like at that point you knew that they were going to try to steal the election. Maybe you could elaborate on that a little
bit. Yeah, I mean, so my case, my legal case, was dismissed on the 5th of May of 2020. And it was dismissed because after a 6-month special counsel investigation, which we were not aware that it was occurring. We had heard different things, but we really weren't aware that it was occurring. And that after 6 months of investigating what they did to me, you know, these unlawful thugs did to me, the Department of Justice dismissed the case. That was May of 2020. So that was before, you know, what I facetiously call the summer of love, right? All the violence that we had on the streets of this country with Antifa, Black Lives Matter, where I think the numbers killed and wounded were of police officers alone was like 30. And there was like $4 billion in damage in multiple places in a very short period of time in a couple of states, right? Washington, Oregon, Michigan, I think up in Minnesota. So after my case was dismissed, that, you know, anybody that followed my case very closely saw that the judge was not going to let go. And it was dismissed for essentially egregious government misconduct. So then the judge kind of holds on to me. You kind of go, well, what's going on here, judge? You know, you don't have any authority to do that. Yet he did. You know, yet he continued to hold on to it for another 8 months, you know, at significant irritation, I'll just say, right? I mean, everything about that was just horrific. So when did I begin to see what was happening for the 2020 election? Well, we had COVID ongoing, right? We had the shutdown of the government, basically the destruction of our small business enterprise in this country. I think 30% of small businesses in this country never reopened after, you know, churches were closed down, everybody's masked up, yet, you know, the Antifa crowds out there burning our cities to the ground. And so as someone who is, you know, as an intelligence professional, someone who analyzes situations and looks at things particularly strategically, even though I can dig into the weeds and get into the tactics of events, as I was started to see the mail-in ballot scheme, right? I call it a scheme. Right, because it's so fraught with fraud in mail-in ballots. So when I started to see these states, like ticking off states that were, you know, all of a sudden, they, you know, this state's going to start having mail-in ballots. States started passing laws, mail-in ballots, and ballot harvesting was going to become legal. And I started to look and go, okay, when did this start? Because, you know, again, I am politically naive, you know, when it comes to a lot of this stuff, because politics was not something that I ever thought I'd ever be a part of in my military career. I never thought I would get involved in it. But I did once I began to see what was going on in our country. So as I started to look at the mail-in ballot stuff, I'm like, okay, what's going on here and what's happening? And so you start to study, I started to study the states where they had mail-in ballots for a long time, much, you know, well before COVID. You know, a state like Oregon. And if I have my dates and sort of the ideological underpinnings correctly, like Oregon, I think, started mail-in ballots like back in like 1998. And when you look at a state like, a beautiful state like Oregon, we had a great event out there in Salem. For anybody that's out in Oregon that's watching this show, we're going to get back out there. But when I looked at that state, I said, okay, 1998, they started mail-in ballots. And I'm like, okay, well, then what happened? What began to happen? I'm doing this because as I'm fighting my legal battle, I'm, you know, trying to figure out what else is going on, because I knew that at the end of the day, I was going to rise above this. And I felt that in my heart. And my wife and I have a long, long, you know, relationship together, and talk about a rock of my family. And so as I started to study this, I'm like going, okay, Oregon since 1998, I don't think it's been anything but Democrat. You know, it's been run by Democrats, right? The major cities and the state since 1998, since they instituted mail-in ballots. So you kind of look at that, just that one example, and that's anecdotal, I know. But you look at that one example and you go, okay, now let's just look at some of the others that are out there. And you begin to say, okay, and I'm hearing the attorney general at the time, and I'm hearing a lot of other people that are talking about mail-in ballots that knew a heck of a lot more than I did about mail-in ballots, how filled with fraud that it is and that it was at that time.
Bill Barr, we've played the clips many times on this show. He was on with Wolf Blitzer saying.
Yeah, Barr said, it's horrible. Yeah. It's a horrible, horrible component. And, you know, I don't know if I saw today, somebody sent me today, not a clip, but an article about Hillary Clinton wanting to have the entire country go to mail-in ballots.
Of course.
So, yeah, I mean, so mail-in ballots, and at that time, I'm watching all this and I'm saying, man, there's something not right. And I having served at the highest levels of our intelligence community, running the Defense Intelligence Agency, being the most senior intelligence officer, military intelligence officer in our nation at the time that I was there. And most people don't know the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, you know, also oversees the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps intelligence components. And there's even budgeting things that we get involved with there, as well as oversight and direction, working in close coordination with the service chiefs, right? Chief of Naval Operations, the Chief of the Air Force, Chief of the Army. So it's a big job. And as I look at these things, I'm thinking to myself, man, and I'm also considering our adversaries overseas, principally China, okay? Principally China. And one of the things that I do know is the infiltration into our government by these anti-American ideologies, particularly communists, for many, many decades has been going on, and particularly the Chinese are very smart about it. I mean, they've been sending 500,000 students to our schools for the last 20 plus years, or to our undergraduate and graduate level schools. You know, I mean, probably the year 2000 was probably 200,000, maybe 300,000. Now it's probably more than 500,000. So let's just say average 300,000 a year, every year for 25 years, at least 25 years now. So that's China sending their students to learn, you know, the STEM, right? Science, technologies, the engineering and math, all these things. So these components combined with this falsehood and this fraudulent mail-in ballot scheme, you know, it just leads to corruption in our election system. And prior to 2016, prior to Trump winning in 2016, the Democrats were screaming about fraud. Mm-hmm. They were screaming about fraud. There's documentaries about it. So we've got to get back to the system, the constitutional system that will allow people that still believe that our nation is built on equality, right? Equality meaning when I go to vote, if I'm a homeless person, but I'm still registered to vote because I just can't get a job, and I'm the most wealthiest person in the United States of America, and I go to vote on that voting day, guess what? We're equal. We are equal. I don't care what that guy's worth and what that guy's not worth. And he's worth, that guy that's the homeless guy is is worth a lot. He's worth a lot, you know, because he's struggling and he's trying hard. He's trying to, you know, rekindle his life. But when they go into the voting booth, when we go into the voting booth, we are all equal. And right now, the American people do not trust our system. So when I talk about our elected officials, we have not had one governor. Okay, not one. And I'm in Oklahoma. Okay, so, you know, I don't want to get you guys into trouble, but that don't matter. I mean, for me, it's like we haven't had one governor, not one sitting governor, not one that has yet said maybe the 2020 election maybe had a little bit of fraud. Even that. Okay, we haven't had one governor that has said that. Not one. You know what they're all doing? They're all letting their egos get in the way of this country and the future of this country. And when you look at the landscape of political candidates running for the highest office in the land, a lot of them are governors or former governors. And you kind of go, you know, because when you become governor, somebody whispers in your ear, oh, now you might, you know, you have a chance of being president of the United States of America. So don't blow it. That's the establishment whispering in their ear. So we haven't had one governor, because if we did, if a governor had the guts to stand up after 2020 and say, you know what, we got some problems here. This doesn't feel right. You know, I mean, you know, it's like old, if it, you know, looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, moves like a duck, swims like a duck, it's a duck, right? So it didn't feel right. It didn't feel right then, and it definitely doesn't feel right now. And all that's happened is more evidence has come to bear. And we still don't have any of these governors. What are they? Why? Because they all want to run for governor. Although they all want to run for president. And it's like, quit allowing your ego. And I'd love to name a few names here, right? But I mean, everybody knows what I'm talking about. Quit allowing your ego and your fake and your false faith get in the way of our country's future and the future of our children and our grandchildren. Why? Because this is for real. It's not just this book. It's this message. It's this title, America Under Attack. And we are under attack. And boy, have I felt it. Have I felt it personally? And guess what? Luckily, blessed, you know, through I wrote a book called Letter to America. And in that book, I talk about faith principally, family, which is a component of faith, and friendship. And what I describe as true friends. Because many people on this, in fact, everybody on this that listens to this show, because there's not a human I've met in my life that hasn't had a tragedy, that hasn't had something happen to them, that hasn't had something bad happen, whether it's a death in the family, a divorce, a drug addiction, whatever, you know, alcohol addiction, you know, something bad happened in your life. And when it did, who were the people that came to your life? Who were the people that came right into your immediate circle and said, I'm with you, and I'm going to stand here with you, and I'm going to help you. I want to help you, right? That's when you're at your worst, when you're in that, as I describe sometimes, the Psalm 23, when you're walking in that shadow, in the shadow of the valley of death there, right? Who's coming to your aid? And that's when you learn about true friends. And that's why I talk about faith, family, and true friends, because we have a lot of friends in our lives and a lot of acquaintances in our lives. But when, you know, when things don't go your way, you know, your company goes bankrupt, let's say, you know, you've been living high in the hog. You've been living, you know, the life of a good American, right? Your capitalism is fine. Make some money, you work hard, and all of a sudden things go south. You know, are the people that you got to that level and you helped get to that level, are they coming to you? And I do think that a part of that, and I'm spending probably more time than you want on that, but I do think that a part of that is we also, like I just talked about with these governors and these people that are running for a political office, right? That, you know, don't let your ego get in the way of what is really a strength of the American. It's one of the greatest character traits, I think, I saw it in American soldiers, is humility. And the idea of humility is so powerful, because when you're on the battlefield, and there's great examples of this, and you're on the battlefield and you're engaged with an enemy, you know, life or death situation, and, you know, when you witness something like a soldier, a young soldier, and you really don't even know what his background is, you know, but he, more than likely he comes from a family somewhere in this country. And you see that soldier, young soldier, I'm talking like 18, 19-year-old kid, and he goes to protect a child, right? And he turns with the child, and there's a great example from the Iraq War. He basically turns and protects the child, and he takes the child to safety, all at the expense potentially of his own life. You know, he's turning his back on fire that's coming at him, and he saves the child. That act of humility, I think that's not just an act of courage and an act of bravery. That's an act of humility. That's humbling yourself, you know, wow, because I'm thinking about it. It's powerful. That's humbling yourself before something so powerful, and you don't even know what that is, but yet you're going to go do that. We don't train that in the Army. That can only come from somebody who just has such a deep-seated sense of themselves, whether it's faith or whether it's their freedom or whether it's their you know, their wife back home or their child or their brother or their uncle or aunt. It doesn't matter. It's such a deep-seated thing that I think only comes from being from experiencing and understanding who you are and having that humility as an American. If we have that, it doesn't mean that you cannot be and you should not demonstrate bravery and courage, you know, under fire. You know, sometimes that's the way it is. But it just means that you have to remember who you are. And I wish that, as I was just talking about governors and talking about our election system, I wish that people would be more humble and step toward the fire and take the incoming that's going to come as governors, right? If you're a governor and you say, I think the 2020 election was stolen. Everything I've seen, it looked like it was rigged. Looks like it was rigged. Now, I have the right to say that because my freedoms right now say that. Allow me that. And a governor is going to take heat from the big-time left-wing media and the mainstream media. They're going to take a lot of heat, you know. But if they're really true to themselves and they stand on their own values and principles, then they should be able to take the heat. Heck, if they want to be president of the United States or they want to be governor of a state, God, you hope that they have that kind of humility and courage. So, anyway.
The theme of tonight's lecture series at Armstrong Auditorium, that is America in Crisis. We're looking forward to that. You've got another soapbox tonight.
Yes.
And last I checked, it was like 670 people are coming. So
yeah,
hopefully we'll sell 30 or 40 more tickets as the day continues. But make sure you come out to Armstrong Auditorium tonight at 6 p.m. That's right here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. And the event, as I say, starts at 6 p.m. He's going to be speaking. There's going to be a Q&A, so you can ask the general a question. We've got some music lined up. It's just going to be a special event from top to bottom. We actually went a little past time today, but that's okay. We've got so much more to get to with General Flynn. We're going to try to squeeze every minute that we can out of his stay. He leaves tomorrow, so hopefully we can record another short segment or two and play it on the Trumpet Daily later this week. You are listening to Stephen Fleury and General Flynn, and we want to see you again next time. It was awesome.
That was great.